Hi, I'm Femi OK. In the United States, a record number of people are dying from drug overdoses. Let me give you an idea of how serious the numbers are. In 2021, the numbers of recorded fatalities meant that it was the equivalent of one person dying every 5 minutes in the United States. According to the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, there is a surge in the number of deaths, particularly amongst people of color, Black communities and Indigenous communities, which is why we're doing this show. I'm going to start with an expert voice. That expert voice is Terence Cooper. He's a needle exchange coordinator.
I say the COVID epidemic and fentanyl, it hit like at the same time. And I think from the epidemic with people not working and people got so much time on their hands, you know, drug usage has went to an all-time high. But definitely with this fentanyl and this new stuff that came out, it's crazy. Since the fentanyl hit, we have seen a definite rise in overdoses. Definitely.
Why is fentanyl and other powerful drugs particularly impacting communities of color in the United States, and what can be done about that? Our expert panel, Andrea, Charles, Maritza, welcome. Good to have you all here on the stream. Andrea, please say hello to our audience around the world. Tell them who you are, what you do.
Hello, however the invitation, my name is Andrea Medley. I'm from the Haida Nation, and I'm calling in from the unceded and occupied Piscataway and Susquehannock territories here in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm currently a research associate at the Center for American Indian Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Hello.
So good to have you. Thank you so much. Hello, Charles. Please introduce yourself to our viewers around the globe.
Hi, Femi. Thanks so much for having me. My name is Charles Hawthorne. I am an equity and harm reduction project manager with the California Bridge Program based out of Oakland, California, where I help emergency departments start harm reduction programs all across the state.
Good to have you on board. Maritza, welcome to the stream. Please introduce yourself.
Thanks for having me. I'm Maritza Perez. I'm based in Washington, D.C. I'm currently the director of the Office of Federal Affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance.
All right, yes, I want to get your quick opinion on what we're seeing right here on my laptop. So this is the rise in U.S. drug overdose deaths by race and ethnicity, 2020 over 2019. Black, 44%. American Indian and Alaska Native, 39%. White, 22%. Asian Pacific Islander, 22%. Hispanic, 21%. What does that tell you, that first glance? Charles, you start.
For sure, yeah. I think that it feels really important for me to be able to, like, contextualize this data within the history of how drug use has looked over the past several years. Thinking about kind of even going back to when drugs were beginning to be criminalized in the early 20s. Drug use has always been criminalized around the boundaries of race in the U.S. That's always been what has really been the trigger point of what drugs are legal and which ones are not. Mm-hmm. So when we kind of think about what's been happening around 2020, I think especially what the syringe access worker was saying in that video earlier, this combined pandemics of fentanyl and COVID coming together, overdose is something that looks very different now than it did even like 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. To 15, 20 years ago before fentanyl, usually when you were seeing overdoses, they were people who had either not used, they were new people who were using drugs. They were people who were changing the method they were using, maybe going from like using pills to injecting, or people who were returning to use after being in jail, after being in drug treatment or being absent for a period of time. When fentanyl began to hit the streets, and you know, fentanyl was not all in one day, it was a wave that occurred over several years, starting in the East Coast and making its way over towards the West Coast. It kind of changed up. It became a thing where people who were very seasoned users, people who were very experienced users, all of a sudden, like, you didn't know what you were taking. You didn't know what dose you were at. You didn't know how much of a percentage this was. You didn't know what was cut into your drugs. And that's always been the case with illicit drugs. You never really know what you're getting.
Let me bring in...
In that context.
Thank you. That's a great start. Andrea, I want to bring you in here because I'm wondering if there's white privilege involved even when drugs are being consumed, because why would the number of fatal overdoses be less for white drug users than for drug users who are of color?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think absolutely white privilege plays a part in this increased overdose rate. And I think the other part of what the data that you shared shows is that Indigenous people, Black people, people of color, we're not getting access to the services that we need, whether that's treatment, whether that's harm reduction. Many people do not feel safe in accessing healthcare because of racism experienced within the healthcare system. I think that's a huge piece of this work. And another thing that it brought up for me is that, you know, these aren't just numbers, these aren't just percentages. Yeah. It's been unacceptable that the rates of overdose have been so high for Black and Indigenous people prior to the pandemic, and that we're shining a spotlight on it now and saying it's terrible. It's been terrible and devastating for so many years, way too long, and that these aren't just numbers, they're people, and people that have meaning in our lives and that we care about. For our family and our friends and our community members.
Our audience are also watching guests on YouTube, and I didn't even invite them to the conversation. They were right in there with us immediately. I like this thought here, which comes from Ricardo, who asks about the apparent ease of getting drugs. Is that going to be problematic? Does that help put the numbers up or the surge up in terms of people of colour in those communities? Charles, you're nodding, and then I'm going to go to Maritza for her take as well. Charles, you start.
I mean, drugs have always been available. No matter where you are in this country, drugs have always been available. What may be the question that is much bigger to kind of ask is what kind of drugs and what quality of drugs are available to people.
Okay.
And so when you think about people who have money and resources, there is very high quality heroin still available in this country. You can spend a lot of money and get very good heroin that is not cut with fentanyl, that is not cut with things. But when you are living on the streets, when you don't have a lot of money, when you're buying heroin illicit drugs, because you're trying to manage pain or because you're trying to deal with the aspects of your life, you get what you can get. And if you don't have a lot of money, you get cheap stuff. And if you get cheap stuff, that's things that are putting you more at risk.
I'm going to go to you, Maritza, but via YouTube again. Another good question. Doesn't this imply lots of what we already know, Maritza? The pandemic affected people of colour more than white Americans. What else can these numbers tell us? Maritza, help us out here.
Yeah, no, I think my colleague spoke to it earlier. You know, this is very sad because these are members of our community. But I think what's also really sad is that these are systemic policy failures that we've known about for decades. We know that there have been inequities throughout all of our social systems, including the criminal justice system, as my colleague pointed out. But we also know that we have disparities in access to health services and other social inequities. I'm thinking about, you know, lack of housing or transportation that could drive somebody to a syringe service program or a health service. But this was certainly all compounded by the pandemic, which is why the Drug Policy Alliance has been pushing for access to harm reduction services to meet people where they're at, including making sure that people have fentanyl test strips so they can consume, so before they consume a substance, they know what's in that substance and they can make a safe decision. Naloxone to reverse the effects of an overdose, but also things like syringe service programs so that people have clean needles and have access to information about substance use. But all of this needs to be addressed in addition to addressing other social inequities, like the inequities in our criminal justice system and access to housing and good paying jobs, all of that. It really does take a holistic approach.
Oh my goodness. Andrea's nodding. Charles is nodding. Andrea, you go first.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate what, you know, Charles had shared around the impacts of prohibition and who is criminalized through our drug laws. And I think that, you know, like Charles was saying, is that access to drugs has always been there. You know, as long as humans have been humans, we've had the ability to create different substances and use plant medicines to alter our experiences. And I think what's really has changed for us is the impacts of, for Indigenous people in particular, colonialism and all of the fallout that comes with that, that creates this pain in our lives. That is one of the drivers of increased substance use.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's a huge point. To kind of tie it back to COVID-19, like during this shelter in place moment, I was in California, I live in California. We were one of the first states to go on lockdown. It's really isolating. We know the things that drive drug use. We know the things that drive overdose. Isolation, not having access to regular medical care, not having access to people who are checking on you, using a loan. Those are all things that like COVID really push forward. And when you combine that with this history of prohibition, and I think like to kind of put it into the human context, people don't trust our government. People don't trust health workers. People are saying, if this person is overdosing, if I call 911, in a lot of states, the police show up. In a lot of states, you don't actually have protection if the police show up and people are using drugs and drugs are there. It's like, so it becomes a question of how did we actually build the system in which this is what happens? We have intentionally built that over decades, over centuries, just absolutely degrading the trust that Black people and Indigenous people have in our system, absolutely degrading the quality of services that people are able to offer. And it feels like a thing. Then we sit back and we're like, but what happened? And it's like, well, what was supposed to happen? What happened was what the intentions of this system were to happen, which were to continue this history of genocide that was started so long ago and to prevent people from being able to get access to those services.
Marisa, I want to focus more on what it takes to stop people from overdosing because it is a needless death, it's a wasteless death, a pointless death, and what the challenges are. So starting with some of the challenges, you've already been building them up for us, so thank you for that. But criminalization is something that came up in our conversation and also from Abdullah, who is a researcher at Brown University. This is what he told us earlier. Have a listen and then build off what he was saying.
So as racial disparities continue to increase in the overdose crisis, I think it's important to remember the counterproductive role that criminalization plays in this whole thing, that you can't have a health and harm reduction approach to treating the drug crisis if people are afraid of being criminalized for using those services. So you can't have outreach workers going and reaching these communities if you then also have these communities that are incredibly policed afterwards. My fear is that as this crisis, becomes perceived to be less white, because of course it hasn't always been white, but it's been perceived that way, that we will see a doubling down in criminalization, which is happening.
Yeah, that's such a great point and something that I think about quite often. I think in some ways this country has made significant strides in terms of providing greater access to health services and harm reduction services for people who use drugs. But I'll tell you what, at the federal level, I see a lot of the opposite happening. I see a lot of the old drug war rhetoric of the past crop up time and time again. I think one specific example of this at the federal level continues to be how we're treating fentanyl right now. On one hand, we're saying people who use drugs need health services, and that's great. But on the other hand, we're also saying that we should treat all fentanyl analogs as Schedule One drugs, that we need to sell people, like we need to put people who are selling fentanyl and trafficking fentanyl in jail and prison. Joe Biden has said that he doesn't believe that anybody should go to jail or prison for drug use, yet he's supporting this effort to criminalize fentanyl analogs and fentanyl itself, further criminalize those substances. And I also have to point out that across the country, unfortunately, we still have laws on the books that criminalize harm reduction tools like clean needles, like naloxone, like fentanyl test strips. These are all literally life-saving mechanisms. So we really need to reverse that and do away with these old drug war tactics of the past, because all of that leads to criminalization and stigma. It will prohibit people from reaching out for help should they need it.
I want to bring you another voice into our conversation. This one comes from Lerando Duncan. He's a resident in DC. He's in his mid-60s. He injects heroin on a daily basis, but he talks about fentanyl and the impact it's been having on other people that he knows who take drugs.
I started using drugs at the age of 18, and I've been on and off of drugs for, for all my life, been using it. So then I started shooting intravenously, started using, and one day I bought some drugs from a guy I know, but I didn't know it was fentanyl, and I went out that morning. The fentanyl killed a lot of my friends. Like almost every 2 weeks, I hear about somebody overdosing on fentanyl that I know.
That story, his story, made me wonder about how communities of color, how indigenous communities are handling having fatal overdoses in their community, having drug use in their communities. Andrea, you start, Charles, then you pick up.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, you know, it's really tough, and it's really tough to have a conversation about it because so much of overdose is truly caused by stigma, shame, and judgment. If we're a person who's using substances, whether we have an addiction or a substance use disorder, or we're using recreationally on the weekends, it's really hard to have that conversation with someone in our lives about our substance use, which then thereby puts us at risk for overdose because of the shame that we have around our substance use. So I think although Indigenous communities have been so severely impacted by this crisis, I think Indigenous communities have the knowledge, the experience, and the tools that will help us get through this crisis, because this is unfortunately one of many crises that we as Indigenous people have experienced, and we know how to take care of each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I really love that last piece. And I think what I would add on to that is within our communities. So I guess I could tell like a little brief story. So in my previous role, I did a lot of harm reduction trainings around San Francisco, working with a lot of different types of groups. And I would always remember when I would be giving trainings to groups of mostly Black staff members or mostly Indigenous staff members, because the energy in the room was very, very different. And so much of that has to do with the historical relationship that our communities have had to drug use, and specifically the relationship we've had to criminalization of substances being used recreationally, of substances being used as part of community, of substances being used to literally just get through the day and work. When we talk about the time period post-slavery during the sharecropping era, where you had Black people making half as much, less than half as much, like 10 cents on the dollar of what white people were making when they were going out and doing manual labor. They were going out and they were using cocaine, and they were using that because that's what you needed to do to work long enough hours to pay your bills. And then you had something like the crackdown around crack that happened in the 80s, the beginning of the war on drugs. And I think about how so much of my family, how so many of my elders have had really, it really brought up a lot for people. When I talk about harm reduction among my Black community and among older folks in the Black community who were like alive during the 80s, it's horrifying. The stories that people tell, the ways that people get caught in these shame spirals around criminalization, getting your kids taken away, not having access to jobs, not being able to get housing, and you're just stuck and stuck and stuck. And that's the system that was created. And then
Charles, is that system gone, mm-hmm. Charles? Is that
absolutely not?
Are we done with that now?
And it's getting broken down. But even if you think about like the system of healthcare. One of the things that, so I guess to kind of tie it back to the work I do at California Bridge, one of the things that we do a lot, we work with emergency departments. And in emergency departments, it is not uncommon when somebody comes in, regardless of what their health issue is, if somebody sees that they have the evidence that they use drugs, they'll just kick that person out. It doesn't matter if it's because your leg is broken or you got a headache or whatever. They won't even engage with you sometimes.
Charles, what's the conversation that you would have with those people? Because there's obviously an education process, even within the medical profession, there's an educational process. Mm-hmm. So if an emergency unit would say, okay, you cannot come in here, you have broken your leg, but you're also on fentanyl, you have to leave. What would you say to the team in that emergency unit?
Yeah. I would say something along the lines of the role of the emergency department is to be an accessible place for people to access care, regardless of their ability to pay, regardless of disability, regardless of medical issue, and regardless of race. And so it is your job as a medical provider to provide this person high quality care. And sometimes what that looks like is just giving them the literal care that they're asking for. And sometimes it's also about giving them some new skills, because a lot of that does come from that stigma and that uncomfortability, and in an even bigger way, not knowing what to do. They don't know, a lot of times providers don't feel adequately trained to provide those services. And so a big part of what we do also is teaching them, here's how you do a start around buprenorphine, which is a medication for substance use disorder. Here's how you start that in the emergency department. You can get a naloxone distribution program and give people naloxone. There's education that you can offer and counseling that is in the ED that is really that's short term and immediate. And I think the more skills that those providers are able to get, the more comfortable that they get being able to actually provide those services and not just have this gut reaction of we don't know what to do.
It seems from our conversation that it doesn't seem to be that expensive, Maritza, to save lives. Charles is laughing. It's sometimes we sort of wrangle with an issue and this is so expensive, we can't actually handle this. But this doesn't seem to be expensive. Am I being naive here? Or is this cheap to save lives? Lives could be saved.
I think that's a complicated question, but I'll tell you what. I see Congress always going to bat for these billion-dollar budgets for the Department of Defense and for war and for weapons, but I don't see that same energy for domestic programs that could really help our people, that could help our residents stay healthy. And I think this is a perfect example of that. We've been fighting with Congress to give us more money for health services, for harm reduction services, for fentanyl test strips and naloxone and syringe service programs. What we're asking for is a drop in the bucket compared to the other things I see Congress pass every day. So it does require meaningful investment, especially because we have these significant racial inequities in access to health services. And to be frank, this is a country that has only recently and only parts of the country have started to embrace harm reduction. Mm. We are in the midst of record number overdose deaths. We absolutely need to scale every service up.
Marissa,
and that's going to require a huge investment.
Marissa, I'm going to show our audience something that shows how new harm reduction is to the United States. Other countries are way ahead of the United States. Have a look here on my laptop. This is a look inside the first official safe injection sites in the US. I'm just going to scroll down here. And what you're seeing, I'm just going to just read here. This is Joe Collado. He's at a clean white table in a sunlit room, and there's a few bars, and he is injecting himself with heroin. When you read that, that's quite startling. I'm now going to show you Nelson Grant, who has also been in that facility in New York, and he explains what he learns as somebody who uses drugs that helps keep him safe. Here's Nelson.
Basically, one of the models is if you're going to use, if you're still going to use, but let us teach you how to use safely. You know what I'm saying? For the intravenous drug users, we're going to teach you how to use safely. We're going to teach you how to, don't ever reuse the same needle, even if it's only you using it. Throw that away, use a clean one. You know what I'm saying? If you have to use the same one, clean it with bleach. You know, we teach you the steps and stuff on how to do that stuff.
I have a minute and a little bit left in this show. I would like to hear your mood guess, whether you're hopeful about harm reduction, that these fatalities in indigenous and people of color communities, if in 2022 there is a hopeful way forward. Andrea, you start.
Sure. Absolutely, I feel hopeful. I think that harm reduction is a new word for indigenous practices that have been happening since time immemorial,
okay. And
that ultimately we are strong communities and we are able to work with each other to protect our communities. And feel hope.
Yeah, let me share the moment with Maritza. Go ahead, Maritza.
I also remain hopeful. I have seen a shift in conversation. I just want us to remember that people who use drugs need health services, need to be treated with dignity, and need to be a part of the conversation. And I find hope in that.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Charles, you bring us home. Wrap us up, Charles.
Yeah, I mean, I think hope is as big as what we're willing to work towards it on. And if we want to continue to grow in this, we have to continue to just like build up the services that actually work and break down the things that don't work, like criminalization. And that's how we move forward.
Thank you so much. You can follow Charles Hawthorne on Twitter at Charles Hawthorne. Back here. There you go. And Maritza is also on Twitter at Maritza Perez. Thank you so much. Also to Andrea for being part of our program today and you on YouTube for your thoughts and your comments. I'll see you next time. Take care.